A Mouthful of Air, a poetry podcast with Mark McGuinness. To His Coy Mistress by Andrew Marvell. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. We would sit down and think which way to walk and pass our long love's day. Thou, by the Indian Ganges side, shouldst rubies find. I, by the tide of Humber, would complain. I would love you 10 years before the flood, and you should, if you please, refuse till the conversion of the Jews. My vegetable love should grow vaster than empires and more slow. 100 years should go to praise thine eyes and on thy forehead gaze. 200 to adore each breast, but 30,000 to the rest. An age at least to every part, and the last age should show your heart. For, lady, you deserve this state, nor would I love at lower rate. But at my back I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity. Thy beauty shall no more be found, nor in thy marble vault shall sound my echoing song. Then worms shall try that long-preserved virginity, and your quaint honour turn to dust, and into ashes all my lust. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. Now therefore, while the youthful hue sits on thy skin like morning dew, and while thy willing soul transpires at every pore with instant fires, now let us sport us while we may, and now, like amorous birds of prey, rather at once our time devour than languish in his slow-chapped power. Let us roll all our strength and all our sweetness up into one ball, and tear our pleasures with rough strife thorough the iron gates of life. Thus, though we cannot make our sun stand still, yet we will make him run. This is a seductive poem in every sense. It's pretty upfront about its seductive intentions. It's written in the voice of a 17th century gentleman addressing a coy mistress, entreating her to be less careful of her honour and to seize the pleasures of the fleeting day. And the poem also seduced me when I was leafing through my copy of Marvell's poems and deciding which one to read for you today. I remember thinking, I'm not going to do that one. It's so well known, it's too famous for its own good. It is one of the most quoted poems in English. Phrases like time's winged chariot and world enough and time are everyday figures of speech. And it's been plundered for titles of not only novels and movies, but also episodes of Star Trek and Doctor Who, not to mention the countless allusions to the poem by other poets, as well as novelists and screenwriters. But then I was leafing through the book, and I read the first few lines, and I was drawn in, and found myself marvelling, if you'll excuse the pun, marvelling all over again at this poem, at its wit, its elegance, its darkness, and also its sense of the urgency and precariousness and preciousness of life. So here we go. The idea that life is short, so we should make the most of it while we can, is hardly an original thought, and it's found in some of the earliest recorded poetry, such as the Epic of Gilgamesh and the ancient Egyptian Song of the Harper, both of which date from around 2000 BC. By Roman times, carpe diem, meaning seize or pluck the day, was a well-known phrase from the poet Horace, who wrote a lot of verse on this theme. And in the 17th century, when Marvel was writing, it was a very common theme, in poems such as Robert Herrick's Gather Ye Rosebuds While Ye May, and Edmund Waller's Go Lovely Rose. And boys being boys, many male poets have seized on the carpe diem motif in order to persuade coy maidens to, well, to stop being coy maidens. And To His Coy Mistress is the exemplar of this kind of poem, balancing the conventions of courtly love poetry with philosophical musings on time, death, and eternity. Is it a profoundly metaphysical poem that meditates on the ephemeral nature of love and life? Or just a shameless attempt to enlist highfalutin concepts in the service of carnal instincts? Well, if I've learned one thing from reading Marvel over many years, it's not to jump to conclusions. So, the poem is written in three verse paragraphs, which correspond to three stages of an argument, which has been described as if, but, therefore, and which we can summarise thus. If we had world enough and time, then I'd love to take my time about wooing you. But, at my back, I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near. In other words, life is short, so we don't have time to be patient. Therefore, we should tear our pleasures with rough strife, thorough the iron gates of life, and tear each other's clothes off before it's too late. And let's give the poet his due. There is more than a grain of truth in this argument. None of us are here forever, so why not make hay while the sun shines? But, of course, just because we might be tempted to make some hay, it doesn't necessarily follow that we'd want to do it with the nearest person to hand. But, of course, the speaker of the poem glides smoothly over this detail and presents his mistress with a binary choice. Come to bed with me, or regret your virginity for all eternity. So what the poem presents us with is a syllogism, a technical philosophical term which has come to mean a specious argument, where the conclusion may sound plausible, but doesn't necessarily follow from the premise. And, you know, it's all very well saying this, but it doesn't really prepare us for the seductive power of the poem itself. Let's take the opening two lines, which posit the if on which the argument of the whole poem depends. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. I can really hear the speaker's voice here, as if we were overhearing him talking to the lady, strolling along in an elegant frock coat and wig in the beautifully designed garden of an English country house. Marvel wrote lots of descriptions of such gardens in his other poems, so every time I visit a country house, it feels like I'm inside a Marvel poem. So I can't help picturing this one being spoken on a leisurely walk among the flowers and quinces and pears and topiary with an ornamental lake in the distance. And the speaker's tone is very relaxed, friendly and charming, but also slightly mocking and ironic. And, you know, the statement sounds perfectly reasonable and plausible until we take a closer look. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. So he's saying, if we had all the time in the world, your coyness, your modesty, your unwillingness to entertain my advances would not be a crime. And notice how he slips that word crime into the sentence right at the very end. He's using the rhetorical technique of presupposition, talking about coyness as a crime, as if that were an established fact. Whereas in fact, it's nothing of the sort. Coyness and modesty were conventionally considered virtues for women within the moral norms of Marvel's day. And of course, the speaker knows coyness is not a crime. And I think we can safely assume his mistress knows this too, so I don't think we're meant to take it at face value. It is transparently deceptive. And of course, transparent deception is a paradox. So within two lines in one sentence, we're already dealing with multiple layers of irony. He's joking, but he's also serious. And she knows this, and he knows that she knows this. And so on. And of course, Marvel doesn't just rely on this flimsy logic. He is bolstering his argument with all the cunning arts of poetry. Listen again. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. Can you hear that? That regular, lulling, hypnotic meter is iambic tetrameter. Titum, 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 titum. He kicks it off with a reversed foot. Tumti. Had we. As if he was stepping out at the start of his walk and offering the lady his arm. And then it becomes as regular as a slow and steady walking rhythm. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. Notice how the full rhyme of time and crime create the illusion of clinching the argument, making it sound truer than true. And I think this illusion of conclusiveness is one reason for the growing popularity of the couplet form in the late 17th century and into the 18th century. This was the age of reason, when writers wanted to sound rational and convincing. They liked to wrap things up in a neat little bow, and rhyming couplets are a great way to do this. So much so that I think they should come with an advisory warning. Reader, beware. This poem is not necessarily to be trusted. Anyway, we're only two lines in. And we are already in danger of falling under Marvel's spell. So, having kicked off by wishing he had all the time in the world, the speaker then tells his mistress what he would love to do in that case. We would sit down and think which way to walk and pass our long love's day. Thou, by the Indian Ganges side, shouldst rubies find. I, by the tide of Humber, would complain. I would love you 10 years before the flood, and you should, if you please, refuse till the conversion of the Jews. In this scenario, where time is no object, they will be free to pass their long love's day. What a beautifully languorous phrase, in the most extravagant fashion. In true courtly love style, he could complain, mope about in love, by the Humber estuary next to the city of Hull, where Marvel grew up and later served as Member of Parliament. And all the while, she could be far off in India. He would love her from before the biblical flood, a proverbially long time ago, until the conversion of the Jews, which 17th century Christians rather arrogantly assumed would happen just before the destruction of the world, on the Day of Judgment. In other words, the two of them could stretch out their courting from ancient times until the end of the world. Next, we get this startling couplet. My vegetable love should grow vaster than empires and more slow. There are a lot of weird images in Marvel, and vegetable love is a prime exhibit, suggesting the slower timescale of the plant world compared to humans. And perhaps other things too. Then we get another feature of courtly love poetry, which we've seen before in episode 50 about Christopher Smart's cat Geoffrey, the catalogue of the beloved's attributes. 100 years should go to praise thine eyes and on thy forehead gaze, 200 to adore each breast, but 30,000 to the rest. An age at least to every part, and the last age should show your heart. But if the catalogue had been done 1,000 times before, and rest assured it had, even by the 17th century, it can rarely have been done with such wit or such elegance, or with such naughty humour as that rhyme of breast with the rest. And then Marvel ends the first paragraph, the if section of the poem, by underlining his faux reluctance to ask her to hurry. For, lady, you deserve this state, nor would I love at lower rate. And on the subject of witty rhymes, isn't that a marvellously abrupt descent from state to rate? I guess it's possible to read rate as relating to speed, but the connotations of price are hard to ignore. On the one hand, he's saying you are a high-class lady, but it comes dangerously close to high maintenance or even high ticket. So he's saying that of course she deserves this state, this absurdly protracted wooing, but what can he do? But at my back I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity. So we are now entering the but section of the poem in the middle paragraph, where he says he would love to wait, but time waits for no man, nor woman neither, as Hamlet would say. And time arrives in a splendid winged chariot. And I'm sure Marvel would appreciate the irony of that wonderful phrase granting immortality to this line about ephemerality. And the swiftness of time means that the speaker and his mistress will soon be lost in the deserts of vast eternity. A wonderful description of death that manages to be both a euphemism and horrifying. Now, strictly speaking, it's nonsense to say that eternity lies before us, because eternity is outside of time. It has no beginning and no end. But as creatures of time, this is how it appears to us when we contemplate death. So I'm pretty sure Philip Larkin, another poet who lived in Hull, had these lines at the back of his mind when he wrote his devastating poem about death, the old fools. Anyway, faced with this memento mori, Marvel's speaker does not, as we might expect, start to think about the state of his soul or reach for philosophical consolation. No, he is far more concerned that the two of them are in danger of missing out on a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for pleasure. Thy beauty shall no more be found, nor in thy marble vault shall sound my echoing song. Then worms shall try that long-preserved virginity, and your quaint honour turn to dust, and into ashes all my lust. And once again, it's really hard to describe the tone of this. There's nothing else quite like it in English poetry. It begins with a genuine sense of mortality and even mourning with the poet's echoing song in the marble vault. But it's flipped almost immediately into a blatant attempt to lure his mistress into bed. There's a kind of macabre, mocking humour that at the same time is weirdly compelling. And perhaps most weirdly of all, none of this stops it being a genuinely moving and thought-provoking poem about the transience of life. T.S. Eliot put it better than I can when he described the tone of this poem as an alliance of levity and seriousness by which the seriousness is intensified. Oh, and there is at least one extremely rude pun in these lines that I will not dare to elucidate, even with my Apple Podcast explicit tag switched on. If you're a Chaucer fan, you'll know exactly what I mean. But if you are offended by crude language, then look away now. Okay, here are the final lines of the second section, the but section. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. There's a delicious horror to this, isn't there? At a later date, this kind of thing would be called gothic. And it partly works because of something I learned when I was a hypnotherapist, and that is negative suggestion. So if I say, don't think of a pink elephant, what do you think of? That's right, a pink elephant. Maybe you imagine an X crossing it out, but the pink elephant is there as an image in your mind because there's no way to picture the opposite of an image. And so when Marvel writes, but none, I think, do there embrace, it conjures up the image of two dead bodies or skeletons embracing in the grave, which is a pretty horrifying image. And I'm sure the speaker knows exactly what he's doing. He is putting the frighteners on her, which makes the image even more dark and disturbing within the world of the poem. But outside of that world, when we consider this as a piece of poetry, then it's frankly superb. It's no wonder these lines are so famous and so widely quoted. In the history of poetry, this feels like a midpoint between the earlier Jacobean metaphysics of John Donne and the emerging elegance of the heroic couplet in poets including Marvel's contemporary, John Dryden, and later on, Alexander Pope. So heroic couplets are rhyming couplets in iambic pentameter, slightly longer than the iambic tetrameter Marvel is using here. And Dryden and Pope have a comparable wit and eloquence to Marvel, but they don't have the heart of darkness that we find at the centre of To His Coy Mistress. And yet the poem doesn't end with darkness, but with light. In the third and final section, the therefore section, Marvel's speaker proposes a solution to the riddle of death. Now therefore, while the youthful hue sits on thy skin like morning dew, and while thy willing soul transpires at every pore with instant fires. Now let us sport us while we may, and now, like amorous birds of prey, rather at once our time devour than languish in his slow-chapped power. We're still young, he says, so let us sport us while we may, which is a fairly conventionally poetic way of putting it. But then we get this slightly troubling comparison to amorous birds of prey. Now, birds are nice and romantic, but why do they need to be birds of prey? It's a bit disturbing, isn't it? Especially when followed by the images of devouring and the slow-chapped power of the jaws of time. So, in spite of his evident enthusiasm, it suggests at least an ambivalence about sex and maybe an undercurrent of violence as well as desire. And then the poem ends with this extraordinary image. Let us roll all our strength and all our sweetness up into one ball, and tear our pleasures with rough strife thorough the iron gates of life. So Marvel was very far from being the first poet to wish the sun would stand still so he would have more time with his lover. On this podcast, we've already heard John Donne asking the rising sun, must to thy emotions lover's seasons run? And Marvel's contemporary, Robert Herrick, in his Gather Ye Rosebuds While Ye May poem, reminds coy lovers that the sun's race will soon be run. But Marvel's is a very idiosyncratic treatment of the theme, even by his standards. At first, it's not even clear that he's talking about the sun. He invites his mistress to join him in rolling all our strength and all our sweetness up into one ball, which sounds like they're going to make a giant snowball together. Then he wants to tear our pleasures with rough strife thorough the iron gates of life. So with the ball image still firmly in our minds, this conjures up a picture of the lovers pushing a giant ball through a pair of iron gates, which is frankly bizarre. It sounds like something out of James and the Giant Peach or Takeshi's Castle. As we've already seen, Marvel's verse abounds in disconcertingly strange imagery. And in his essay on Marvel, T.S. Eliot says he doesn't always get away with it. But in this instance, I think he does. It's ridiculous, but somehow it works, even though I can't quite work out why. And it reaches a terrific conclusion. Thus, though we cannot make our sun stand still, yet we will make him run. There's an acceleration in that final line, which means the poem takes off just as it looks like it's running out of road. The if and but have been transmuted into even though. And after spending 45 lines resisting the forward momentum of time and of the sun, the poem suddenly decides to go with it. And on one level, it's a facile ploy, a part of the speaker's transparent seduction technique. But at one and the same time, as we have seen, this frivolously erotic poem is also a genuine meditation on death. So I don't think it's too much of a stretch to also read this ending as a joyful ascent to life itself. So, that's Andrew Marvel's To His Coy Mistress. And if ever a poem was begging for a response, it's this one, isn't it? Because we never hear from the mistress herself, or even glimpse her. So it's anybody's guess what she made of it. And inevitably, other poets have risen to the challenge and written responses in the voice of the mistress. Annie Finch has a delightfully terse reply in her poem, Coy Mistress, and AD hopes his coy mistress to Mr. Marvel is a takedown that is even longer than the original. I'll include links to both of these poems in the show notes, and if you know of any other poems written in the voice of the coy mistress, I'd love to hear them. But I don't think it was an oversight that Marvel doesn't include the coy mistress's perspective in the poem, and it feels a bit too easy to dismiss this as chauvinistic disregard for her point of view. A poet as clever as Marvel would have been very well aware that he'd presented readers with one half of a dialogue, and that we would naturally start to fill in the other half with our imagination. Nowadays, we're used to reading poems as if the eye of the poem is the same as the eye of the poet, and it's certainly possible that this poem was inspired by a real woman Andrew Marvel knew. Even in that case, though, it's pretty clear that the speaker of the poem sees courtship as a game, and his ambiguous tone suggests that it's finely balanced whether he's playing to win or simply for the fun of it. And it's also possible to read this poem as a dramatic monologue, written more for its effect on the reader than to express a private passion. In which case, it's hard to escape the feeling that this most subtle of poets is playing a delightful and disconcerting game with us. To His Coy Mistress by Andrew Marvel. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. We would sit down and think which way to walk and pass our long love's day. Thou, by the Indian Ganges' side, shouldst rubies find. I, by the tide of Humber, would complain. I would love you 10 years before the flood, and you should, if you please, refuse till the conversion of the Jews. My vegetable love should grow vaster than empires and more slow. 100 years should go to praise thine eyes and on thy forehead gaze. 200 to adore each breast, but 30,000 to the rest. An age at least to every part, and the last age should show your heart. For, lady, you deserve this state, nor would I love at lower rate. But at my back I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity. Thy beauty shall no more be found, nor in thy marble vault shall sound my echoing song. Then worms shall try that long-preserved virginity, and your quaint honour turn to dust, and into ashes all my lust. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. Now therefore, while the youthful hue sits on thy skin like morning dew, and while thy willing soul transpires at every pore with instant fires, now let us sport us while we may, and now, like amorous birds of prey, rather at once our time devour than languish in his slow-chapped power. Let us roll all our strength and all our sweetness up into one ball, and tear our pleasures with rough strife thorough the iron gates of life. Thus, though we cannot make our son stand still, yet we will make him run. Andrew Marvell was an English poet and politician who was born in 1621 and died in 1678. Many of his poems reveal surprising depths in relatively minor subjects, as in The Seductive to His Coy Mistress, or his descriptions of gardens and pastoral scenes. Marvell served as Member of Parliament for Hull during the English Civil War and later the Restoration. The nimbleness required to navigate such changing times is reflected in the ambiguous tone of his Horatian Ode upon Cromwell's return from Ireland. He served as Latin Secretary to Cromwell's Council of State alongside John Milton and contributed a poem on Mr. Milton's Paradise Lost to the second edition of his friend's great poem. A Mouthful of Air is a poetry podcast hosted by Mark McGuinness. A new episode is released every month. If you enjoy the show and you would like to help me connect more poets with listeners and readers, you can contribute to the show's production costs at amouthfulofair.fm/support. You can also support our poets and publishers, as well as the podcast, by buying their books in the A Mouthful of Air bookshop at amouthfulofair.fm/bookshop. And if you would like a full transcript of every episode sent to you via email, you can sign up for this at amouthfulofair.fm/subscribe. A Mouthful of Air is produced by the 21st Century Creative, with music by Javier Weyler, sound production by Breaking Waves, and visual identity by Irene Hoffman. Thank you for listening. I'll be back soon with another poem.